I'll be reading Proverbs chapter 15:8, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling.
Good morning. You ever stop to consider what a privilege that it is for us to come together with each other to worship God? I enjoy worshiping God by myself too, but I really enjoy it when we all get together. It's such an encouragement. Today, if you'd like to open your Bibles, we'll be in Daniel chapter 5 as we continue our series, Life in the Lion's Den. And today we will be considering the handwriting on the wall from Daniel chapter 5. I had a little situation that's been running around in my mind, and I'll just briefly tell you about it. I've been concerned that I need to purchase more things made in America so I can put my neighbors to work. Now, that's just my personal thinking. I'm not trying to push that on you, but that's something that I've really been thinking about. So I needed a new set of screwdrivers. And I determined in my heart that I was going to buy a set of screwdrivers made in the great United States of America. And after looking for 2 months, I could not find a set of screwdrivers made in the United States of America. Until I went where are you at, Brother Sam? Sam Giddings? Oh, he just went out back. Well, you can probably hear me out in the hall. Brother Sam Giddings works at Granger's, and I found me a set of Proto screwdrivers made in the United States of America. And they must have thought they were gold, because they charge according to gold standard. But I purchased a set of screwdrivers made in the United States of America. And you can see what great effort that I went to do this. And I come home. My wife had taken one of those screwdrivers that meant so much to me. And she was dipping wood putty out of the can with it. That's a sin that's in the Bible somewhere. You just read and look at it. Well, the next day I come home and another one of my nice screwdrivers had paint all over it. I don't know if she was stirring the paint with it or whatever, but you know what? How would you feel when you have something that's really important to you and somebody uses it for some other reason? How many people in here have computers? How would you feel if you come home and some other member of your family was digging a hole out in the yard to plant a tree with your monitor? You wouldn't like that very good, would you? Using things that are intended for one purpose, using them for something else. Well, you know what, church? In today's lesson, it's my hope that you'll understand that there are certain things that that God has given us that are intended for certain uses, and He wants us to use them in the right way, okay? Now, I'm going to come back at the end of the sermon and follow up on that point, but I just wanted to get you thinking about it. So here we go in Daniel chapter 5. First of all, just to set this up just a little bit, Israel is going to be in captivity for 70 years. Okay? When the 70 years started, when it stopped is a little bit of contention, but I'm in the camp. I think it started in 605 B.C. and went to 536 B.C. Whatever you're camping, it doesn't really matter too much, but this does matter. By the time of chapter 5 of Daniel, we're getting close to the end of 70 years. Nebuchadnezzar is not king anymore. Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon, died in 561 B.C., followed by some folks, and it ended up being Nabonidus is the last king of Babylon. Now, if you're reading your Bibles, you might be going, what? Okay, stick with me. The last king of Babylon was a man named Nabonidus. Okay? We're getting down toward the tail end. By the time we finish this chapter, Babylon will not exist anymore. It'll be over. Done with. History. Never to come back. Daniel is an old man. That's the setting. That's what's going on. Israel had been in captivity all that time. Learned lessons, hopefully. Some of them, I wonder, if I could just sit and talk to some of these Israelites, I'd like to say to them, by the time of the writing of chapter 5, I'd like to say, what have you learned after 67, 68 years of captivity? What have you learned? You know, I think that maybe some of the people had learned some great lessons. I wonder if some of the people had just grown accustomed to living in Babylon. Those are things that sparked my imagination as I began to consider our text for today. Our text begins Daniel chapter 5, verse 1 through 4. Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. And he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, so that the king of his nobles, his wives, his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, stone, and wood. This is King Belshazzar. Don't confuse it with Nebuchadnezzar's designation for Daniel, Belt-Tazhazar. Daniel was referred to as Belt-Tazhazar. This is Belshazzar, okay? Different guy. Now, I want to tell you about who Belshazzar is. Belshazzar's dad is Nabonidus. Nabonidus being the last king of the Babylonian Empire. Belshazzar and Nabonidus are co-regent kings. They reign together at the same time. And you're going to pick up on that as we study through. When the designation is given to Daniel that he would be third greatest in the kingdom, you're going to understand a little bit more about that. So Belshazzar is reigning in Babylon. Yeah. His father, Nabonidus, which wasn't very popular at all, he was off in a place called Tama. It sounds like Tama County, something like that. I can't pronounce it. He was off over there because of his great unpopularity that he had in Babylon, and he's over here doing all this moon god worshiping stuff. History records that. You can see that. So that left this guy Belshazzar in Babylon, and he is the king of Babylon as a co-regent with his father. So Belshazzar calls for a great feast. He calls his nobles together. He has a block party and calls 1,000 people. That's a lot of people. I don't know if you've had any party lately, but my house won't even hold 1,000 people. But he calls 1,000 people together. And it says that he's tasting the wine. He's dipping into the sauce. His wives and his concubines are at this party. It's suggested by scholars that there's lasciviousness as well as drunkenness going on at this party. And history certainly records the drunken end of it, which we'll get to in a little bit. But at this great party, Belshazzar decides to bring out some things that he happened to remember that his father who? Nebuchadnezzar. Now, I just told you that his father was Nabonidus. How do you understand that? In Bible times, the record of whose father, I could say Abraham is my father, right? Jews did that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Belshazzar's grandfather was Nebuchadnezzar. His immediate father was Nabonidus. History records that as well, but you can understand the same implication. Is my grandfather my father? Yep. My dad? Yep. Here, Belshazzar remembers that his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken this plunder from Jerusalem. So he breaks out the plunderous vessels of gold and all that from that was in the temple, utensils used in the temple, and he passes around like Dixie cups to pour the wine into for people to drink. It wasn't because he didn't have Dixie cups. Are you with me? Am I making the point? He brought these vessels out of arrogance and pride. This was part of our spoil. I'm showing you, Babylon, that I'm in control as king. This was a boastful, prideful thing to bring out those utensils. Now, I want you to stop and think about those utensils. Do you know anything, especially from the reading of Chronicles, do you know anything about those utensils that's a bit interesting? Those utensils that were to be used in the service in the temple were anointed with oil and sanctified, consecrated for special use to God. Here is a pagan worshiping man bringing these utensils that have been dedicated to the living God out to use in a drunken orgy. I just want to ask you a little preparatory question. How do you think God feels about that? From those vessels, as they drank the wine, the text says that they praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and stone and wood. Man, it breaks your heart to think about something that's been consecrated, dedicated, and devoted to God now being used to drink wine out of and praise the God of gold, praise the God of silver and bronze and stone and wood. It's an abominable thing that's happening. The utensils of God are being used in a paganistic way. Then God crashes the party. I like this part. Verses 5 through 9 says this. Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack and his knees began knocking together. Uh-oh. In the midst of this great party, a man's hand, the Hebrew says, came forth. Now, I'm not sure if that means it just appeared or if it floated down through the crowd, but let me tell you what. If I'm at the crowd and I see either a man's hand floating down through the room or if it just appears, I might join Belshazzar and get a little bit nervous. The crowd was drunk. And you know what? Drunk people end up doing a whole lot of laughing, end up passing things off as not important when they are. But let me tell you what, a man's hand appearing before the king in this fashion was like 50 cups of coffee. Nebuchadnezzar turned serious real quick. He knew that there was no party trick involved. You know what? God, church, listen to me. God knows how to speak your language. You know, you've got your own particular language. Each one of us have learned to communicate in our own ways. And let me tell you something. God knows your language. And God knew Belshazzar's language as well. The great and mighty king grew pale. His thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack. Now, you know what I thought about that? How could you know if your hip joint went slack? Are you just sitting there and you got this feeling that your leg just starts going to the floor without your body? I have a feeling he tried to stand up and he learned the lesson that his hip joint was going slack. And listen to this. And his knees began to knock. Just a few moments ago, Belshazzar was pounding on his chest. Whoa, look at me. Now his knees are knocking. God has a way of doing that to each one of us. When we get out of line, he knows how to reel us in. You know, I tell you that because I know I've been there. I've got out of line and God reeled me in. I'll be pounding on my chest and God starts my knees knocking. That's what happened to Belshazzar. So Belshazzar called for his royal entourage, the conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners, and he offers them a reward if they can read and interpret the writing. The reward included having the next line of authority, be promoted to the third position in the kingdom. The first position in the kingdom belonged to Nabonidus, who he was co-regent with. The second position was his. So he offered them the very highest thing he knew to offer, and that was third place of authority in the kingdom, which was directly under him. But the wise men, the text says, that they could not read the writing or give the interpretation of it. And at that, the king's face grew even paler. You know what? Just like Nebuchadnezzar, King Belshazzar here, he's seen something. He's seen this hand appear out of nowhere and write something on the wall of his palace. And he knows that this is really important. After all, if a man's hand appeared in your home, not connected to a body, and wrote you a note on the wall, would you find that something that you need to figure out something about? Yeah. And he was pretty disturbed about it. He wanted to know about it. So he called in his royal entourage to figure out what was going on with that writing. And you know what? They didn't know. They couldn't say. Couldn't read it. Couldn't tell what it meant. Nothing. So the queen, in verses 10 through 12, not to be confused with his wives, because his wives were on the scene in verse 1, this is the queen mother. This is Nabonidus' wife. She comes to him and she says, Belshazzar, don't be alarmed in your thinking. Don't let this thing tear you down, because let me tell you what, there's a man in the kingdom who knows mysteries, who can interpret enigmas, the text says, things that are seemingly impossible. It's Daniel. Daniel served your father, your grandfather. He served Nebuchadnezzar, and he's got this ability. You need to call Daniel in. You know what? You need to know something about this. This is a significant part of the text you could just gloss over without realizing it. Daniel wasn't at the party, folks. They had to call him in. Sometimes we feel like if there's a party, we got to be there. Don't we? In our little groups of friends, if somebody's having a party, we don't want to offend them. We want to show up. We want to try to be godly, but sometimes we find ourselves where we ought not to be. And you know what? Daniel wasn't where he shouldn't have been. Daniel wasn't at the party. They had to send out for him. He wasn't there. So Daniel is called before the king, verses 13 through 16, where the king says, are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? So he questions him. He asks him, is he that guy? And he tells him, verse 15, just now the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they couldn't do it. Can you help me? That's what the king is saying to Daniel. He says, now listen, Daniel, if you're able to help me out, here's what I'm going to do for you. I'm going to clothe you in purple, the color of royalty. I'm going to put a necklace of gold about your neck. In other words, you're going to have some cash on hand. You're going to get rich. And you'll be given the highest position of authority. And here's what Daniel says, verses 17 through 24. He says, King Belshazzar, you keep your gift. I don't want nothing to do with it. Give it to somebody else. Ooh, you know what? We live in a culture today where you never refuse anything that's offered to you. We live in a world of entitlements where we stick out our hands. Anything you're willing to put in it, I'm willing to take. You know what? God's people ought to be careful what they take into their hands, because not everything's right. One person says, I'll go down here to the gambling joint, I'll win $1 million, and I'll give it to the church. Let me tell you what, church. The church would be better off without the $1 million. Because it's money that's been robbed from somebody else. Daniel says, listen. Daniel says, I'm not going to take your money. But he says, I'll help you with the dream. Daniel begins by explaining the overall purpose of the hand. He reminds King Belshazzar that it was God who made King Nebuchadnezzar great. But King Nebuchadnezzar's heart became arrogant and proud, and God put him out to pasture, which God will do with the proud. Then Daniel says, listen to this. He says, even though you knew all this, verse 22, you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. Daniel tells Belshazzar, you had a model example in your life. Your grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, had this whole scenario happen to him where his heart got prideful, he exalted himself, God struck him down, put him out to pasture. You knew about this, you watched it, you had a first-hand example, you rejected it, and as a matter of fact, he says, your rejection was against the God of heaven. I wonder, just asking myself, how many times God has given me an example and how many times I've looked the other way. I can tell you that I have looked the other way when I had the proper example set before me. You know what? Probably all of us in here have had that happen to us. Toward the end, verse 23, it says, but God, in whose hand are your life breath and all your ways, you have not glorified, Daniel tells him. Then, he said, the hand was sent from him and the inscription was written out. The inscription. So he says, look, Belshazzar, what you need to know to begin with is the purpose for the hand showing up in the first place. The purpose is because you got prideful, you got arrogant, you didn't learn the lesson of your father, grandfather, you didn't learn that. And as a matter of fact, you pitted yourself against the God of heaven, and he sent this hand to show up at your party and to write on your wall. Verses 25 through 29, the inscription that was written out on the plaster of the king's palace was Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. I had to remember how to pronounce that. So I wrote that inscription on the chalkboard in my class this morning, and I asked all the kids, I said, hey, do you know what this is? Do you know what it means? Yada, yada, yada. I had, 10 kids? 2 kids did know, which I found really good. Colton and Alexander knew. They identified, they saw that, and Alexander was even turning to Daniel chapter 5. So he knew about that. But here's what was written on the plaster wall. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. The first word, you may not know it, but you know that it's repeated. It is important because it is repeated. It's done that way for emphasis. As you look through these words in Daniel here in chapter 5, you understand that the meaning of these words really lends toward a systems of weight and measurement, weighing out money in particular. The first word is mene, mene. It means God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. How many of you ever go down here and you go to some place and you have to take a number? You go to Pizza Hut, there's 20 people standing at the door, take a number. Take a number and you're standing there waiting until your number comes. Hey, let me tell you what, Babylon's numbers just come up. You know what the number says on it? Numbered and the end. Your numbers come up, your time has showed up, this is the end of you. Then he says, tekel, or tekel, I don't remember which one. You've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. You see, a set of scales are like this. You picture a set of balance scales, you see a plate on each side hanging by some chains. You put a standard on one side, and then you put gold or whatever on the other side until it balances, then you know what the weight is because it's measured off the standard. God is the standard of His people. God is the standard for this world, and according to His balance scales, Babylon has come up short. It doesn't match the requirement. They have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. And finally, upharsin, you notice during the in verses 25 through 29, during the description, he uses the word peres. Instead of the initial word that you heard was written on the wall, upharsin. Scholars say, and I don't know for sure, but they say that this is the plural of the singular word, upharsin. I don't have a clue about that. The text doesn't tell me. However, the text does point to the fact that this is a description of the last word. Okay? And the last word means, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. So here's Daniel. He's talking to King Belshazzar, who has had this hand right on the wall. He's scared about it. He calls in his best cohort to tell him what's going on. They said, we ain't got a clue. And here comes Daniel. Daniel says, hey, that means numbered, weighed, and divided. You're done. That's what it means. Your time's over.
Now this king, he could have looked at it.
Verse 30 says that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about age 62. History records that the Babylonians that night were so drunk that there was little and no resistance offered when the Medes and the Persians come in to take over the place. As a matter of fact, Isaiah says they opened the door to them. Come on in, the party's roaring. Oh, you're our captor. Babylon was over right then and there in that moment. God had raised Babylon up as His vessel to haul His people off into captivity. Now, I want to help you with the concluding thought for this whole story. So if you say, Dan, this is a great story. This really has a lot of good meaning. But what does it mean to me today? You, church, are a vessel of the Lord. How do you think God feels when His vessels that are meant for holy purposes are used in unclean ways? This book was written for God's people. Israel was a vessel of God that had been used in an unholy way. They had used themselves in an unholy way. You see, as you're reading here, you're understanding about Belshazzar using the vessels of God in an unworthy manner, in a not proper way, and the condemnation that comes from God in accordance with that. But the greater picture is that Israel, as a vessel of God, had allowed themselves to be used in unholy ways. Israel was God's people. Church today, you are God's people. You are sanctified in the blood of Jesus. You have been consecrated. You are set apart to be holy. And when you go out in your lives and you do things that are unholy, it is nothing different than what happened in the story. It's the using of what is holy for that which is common. We go out and we make decisions every day, and you know what we think? These decisions don't really matter. They don't really amount up to anything. You know, it's like, oh, I'm just one person. What difference could I make? What does it matter if I go down here on Friday night and I go to a party and I get drunk? It's not really going to matter. And you say, Dan, church people don't get drunk. You're nuts. That's my answer. You say, well, Dan, if my single life, it doesn't matter. If I go off over here when nobody's looking and I get me a pornographic magazine and I check that out and I get, you know, I get to lusting after the flesh, what difference? I'm just one person. You matter, church, because you are the vessels of God. You are the instruments of His hand. Every single decision matters. Israel didn't get the picture. God put them on ice for 70 years. Well, has God ever put you on ice? He has me. He sent me out in the wilderness more than once. Israel needs to learn something in the wilderness. What is it that they've learned? What is it that they should be learning? Maybe nothing. Right now there are people in here who are in the wilderness. Are you getting what God's got for you? Are you squirming around and kicking around like a little kid who's ready for church to be over? You know that old tendency? Let me tell you what, if you're out there in the wilderness, learn what it is God has for you. Because when you come out of the wilderness, God can use you in an effective way, in a mighty way, for His glory and for His kingdom. Praise be to God.
Amen.
Even when He sends us into captivity, right? This morning we're going to sing a song of invitation. Maybe you're in captivity and you just need us to pray with you.
Maybe you just got out of captivity and you want to thank God. Maybe you need to go into captivity and maybe you need to talk to God about that. How can we help you as a church? We begin to help you by putting our arms around you and praying with you. If you have a need,